show me the way to the next whiskey bar. Al, don't ask why. Al, don't ask why. Show me the way to the next whiskey bar. Al, don't ask why. Al, don't ask why. For if we don't find the next whiskey bar, I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die. I tell you, I tell you, I tell you we must die. Oh, moon of all the moment, we now must say goodbye. With love, I'll get out my mind. I must have whiskey on the wine. Oh, moon of all the moment, we now must say goodbye. Show me the way to the next little girl. Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why. Show me the way to the next little girl. Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why. For if we don't find the next little girl, I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die. I tell you, I tell you, I tell you we must die.
Welcome to the Listening Tide. That was The Doors, an Alabama song, Whiskey Bar. Our guest today is Orlando Mike Gouwenberg. Orlando, welcome.
Thank you.
We have a lot of peculiar tracks that we bring in play. This is a bit of a surprising one, but also the reason we're playing it, I think, is it's more of a surprise than our listeners would think. Can you say a little bit about it?
In preparation to this opportunity to talk to you about listening and what it can mean, we were talking about earworms, and then I said, like, oh, I have one earworm that I have since I'm 14, I think.
14 years old.
Yeah. I heard, and so it's this song. I never listened to it, actually.
Yeah.
I just happened to hear myself whistling it when I'm alone, or it's just in my head.
Yeah, for anybody that doesn't know what an earworm is, it's a tune or a melody or something that has a certain composition to it,
yeah,
that gets stuck in your head.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
repetitively,
and it comes from an experience in. When I was 14, I think, I was working on a farm in the south of Germany, in the Schwarzwald.
Schwarzwald, yes.
And, I was there with my friend. And then these guys that were also working there, we were always hanging out with them. They were listening to The Doors all the time.
Yeah.
And this is, I think, where I picked it up. And it just never left my left my head.
Yeah, so when you're sort of washing the dishes or in the and car and it's sunny like a day today.
Exactly, and it's only the refrain actually, or the, what is it, the chorus.
Ah, the Moon Over Alabama.
Yeah. And I also, it's also a little bit faster than what when you hear the song now, because I literally haven't listened to it for many, many years.
Yeah.
So it sounds very slow. And so it's a little bit faster. And what I happen to have is when I don't listen to a podcast or other music, when I'm by myself and on the streets and walking or biking, and if I'm in a good mood, I just start whistling. And then I sometimes whistle this.
And we chose to play the track because it is perhaps the earliest earworm that you can remember, or at least the longest lasting one, arguably.
Yeah, there are some others from childhood songs, or but they are more connected to school or like other things. And I think this is a better example.
And maybe if it's interesting, maybe to discuss this as things that have made themselves comfortable or maybe camouflaged, cloaked, found their way, nestled their way into your memory, into your ear. But the next thing that we also want to speak about is when the ear or the body and that opportunity to sort of absorb sounds resists. It turns itself off from this.
Yeah, that's a very good way of describing it, actually.
I understand it's called misophonia, as you sent to me.
I mean, misophonia is a disease that is really existing.
Yeah.
And people have it when they cannot absorb sounds. So they're triggered by different types of sounds. For instance, by my voice or by the sound of a car or the sound of someone writing down or even anything. And I have a little bit similar thing because I happen to have long COVID, which makes you very aware of everything. It makes you basically hypersensitive and you get triggered very quickly. So because you're overloaded all the time, or very quickly, let's say it like that. It's not all the time. But more, I noticed at some point that I happen to be in situations where I get triggered very quickly by the sound of my surroundings.
Mm.
And it can even be in a conversation that all of a sudden someone's voice is almost too much.
Mm.
And it's very unpredictable also. So when I was thinking about this interview or this conversation, I thought it's actually interesting to talk a little bit about the body and sounds and how we're related to the space, the context that you're in, and how all these, how the sounds around you are so important for your well-being, and that you're normally, like before I had, so before I never had this, maybe when you're super, super tired.
Right.
But
was accelerated through, because it sounds like a diagnosis. I mean, that's what we're speaking about here. Long COVID does result or can or often does result in this sort of acute sense of hearing or other things that affect the body and the body's awareness of its surroundings.
And everyone has it differently. So I find it very difficult to talk about long COVID as something that is similar for more people. But
sure.
I know that sound and light is for sure one of them. And some people also experience it when you have fever or when you have COVID, that all your senses are activated and kind of overloaded. And this, I think with long COVID, or at least with me, it works like this.
Yeah. Should we have the listener listen to just a few examples of this? Because we did find online a YouTube channel that has the misophonia test.
Yeah, it has the misophonia test, but
yes,
I think it's very good to hear it. But afterwards, we can maybe talk about how it's. This is quite. I think it's a quite rough or black and white or like binary idea of what it could be.
Yeah,
the misophonia. Yeah.
In that sense, too simple of saying it's like this, but not that. And
Yeah, and also I don't know if they're chosen so well for this test.
Okay. All right, well, let's just hear like three or four, maybe great. Five, and then we'll discuss it.
Yeah.
That was Clinking Glasses keyboard, and a mad keyboard at that. the crumpling of a bag. It sounded a bit like plastic and paper at the same time. The scratching of a fork over a plate. It's a bit more like a pan to me. And of course, the universal squeaky door.
Yes.
Yeah, quite black and white, almost cartoonish sort of sounds. Yeah, exactly.
But I find this very good examples, actually, even though they're very simple and black and white, because normally you would hear them in combination, mm-hmm. or like you hear a little bit. You can just hear, for instance, someone typing in the background.
Yeah.
And that it really comes across as if it's like straight in your ear.
Yeah.
And this is, I think, this misophonia. And while looking into this, we also looked at Oliver Sacks, the scientist, because he speaks about this. He has this book about it, and it's more connected to the brain. And I liked his example where he speaks about someone who had an injury, and then after recovery, that person could, when they listened to classical music, mm-hmm. they heard as if all the cutlery in the kitchen falls out of the drawer.
Oh, wow.
So this is what I try to find. But so this, if you imagine all these sounds that you just heard together.
Yeah.
And I found it super fascinating of Oliver Sacks. That's also kind of an earworm in my thinking, actually.
Yeah.
Throughout the years that I'm like, oh, yeah, it's so interesting how the brain works and how perception works, and that it's just... Yeah, it's basically something in your brain that translates a certain information into a sound.
It doesn't have to be at the hand of Oliver Sacks' own theories or research, because I don't think either of us are expert enough in that to discuss it.
No.
But if we would speculate a little bit, do you think there's a possibility that those operate on a specific sound wave or a level of sound? Neurologically speaking, or is it a combination of neurology and psychology that come from these kind of situations?
I think it's both, actually.
Hmm.
Because I mean, I can only speak for myself.
Sure.
But But I think that psychology influences a lot on how you perceive things.
Yeah.
So also when you look back into your own life, like how you sometimes deal with things.
Mm-hmm.
And even when I'm triggered, I can sometimes feel, yeah, then maybe I'm triggered more when I'm tired, but sometimes it's also more a psychological state that makes you triggered more, you know?
I ask because this is an interesting thing to discuss also where we'll be headed in the episode shortly, but that understanding of the body being the carrier and sort of both the radar,
yeah,
and the satellite,
yeah, exactly,
of the understanding of surroundings. Long COVID in your case, and perhaps for others, and perhaps for others other things, sort of enhance and accelerate this awareness, this position that you have sonically and psychologically to that, what makes those sounds. But on the one hand, the neurological level has, I've always understood to be really the science of the machinery itself. And the psychological is sort of the software that runs through the machinery and how it sort of like informs each other. Speaking as an epilepticus, having had a lot of conversations with neurologists,
yeah,
this is my amateur conclusion. When it comes to this as a topic, I think it's really interesting, especially how accelerated these, but maybe that's also a question to you. Do you think these confrontations, if I can call it that, have become more accelerated in general in terms of our surroundings? Because we were thinking about, we couldn't find the track, unfortunately, yeah, where the disappearance of birds is creating more silence in a natural ecological way.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, arguably, there's
constantly other sounds.
There's also a lot of distractions and other sounds.
Sound pollution, as they call it.
Exactly.
But I think it's interesting what you say about the relationship between the brain and the psychology, because the psychology is also your brain producing it. So it's just trying to protect you.
Mm-hmm.
Or that's what I understood from how the brain, how the brain works. That it's basically always trying to do the best that you, for you as a body and a person. And then it, of course, has a lot of glitches.
Sure.
But so I find it interesting to see the psychology as the software and the brain as the hardware.
Yeah.
But then, like, having this situation that I have to be super careful about how to use my energy, mm-hmm, how to make sure that I don't get triggered so fast, it really also asks a lot from my psychological being. To also push yourself, because you can also easily become hypersensitive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very fine balance.
And possibly a vicious cycle.
And a totally vicious cycle.
Yeah.
So you need to really keep pushing yourself. Otherwise, I think you will never get rid of it. But what I find, if we go back to Oliver Sacks a little bit.
Yes, please.
He was also talking about musical hallucinations.
Mm-hmm.
Which are more like that you, all of a sudden, you have some kind of sound, a sound experience that you cannot even, has no trace of where it comes from or what it is. So he had, for instance, that he doesn't speak German, and all of a sudden he was singing, heard himself sing a German song, and it was related to a certain trauma, because he asked some people to help him to find the cause of this.
Mm-hmm.
And this I found also interesting, that that your brain is so inventive to just grab stuff from I don't know where. And maybe that's also where we can go to the interconnectedness.
Mm.
Because how does he get a German song into his head, you know?
Yeah.
While not even being able to speak it, and also not necessarily be in contact with that particular music. And this is also something that always fascinates me, how ideas are traveling, how you can listen to each other through different types of media, by like I have a lot of telepathy with people.
Yeah.
But you have to, like, all these different ways of listening to the context, or how we communicate with our bodies, how we communicate through sound, language, everything. Yeah,
I did come across a study that in an academic sense, proved the relationship between sound waves and hallucination.
Oh, wow.
That does lead to seeing specific colors and distorting certain vision, which otherwise is unperceptible in hearing itself. So in other words, sound waves that cannot be heard, but in fact are being picked up by the brain and impacting what the brain sees, for will of a better word, or experiences in terms of colors and contour.
But they are sound. They are sound waves.
In the end, they're waves that are produced by sound and contained in a laboratory circumstance, which I think is interesting. And if I may use that as a lead into the next contribution that you brought,
but that's also connected to the
to Oliver Sacks.
I listened to Pharrell Williams, for instance, mm-hmm. in a very nice interview about his new Lego film, mm-hmm. and he also sees sounds in colors.
He does.
Yeah. And everyone who does have that
sees
different colors. So that's also interesting.
They see a different color.
They see different colors for different sounds.
Yeah.
But then also between people, it's often different colors. So it's also, again, connected to psychology, I think, and how you perceive things more on an emotional level.
And not necessarily a human level.
Yeah. Not necessarily a human level.
Is that my step? Can I use it?
Yes.
Alexis Pauline Gums, you brought, what's the right word, poetry? Yes, perhaps.
Yes,
writing?
Writing.
We'll leave it in the middle if we call it that. This has to do with that interconnectivity, as far as I understand what she was just mentioning, but one that doesn't claim the arrogance of the human as sort of the zenith of that. It's not an Anthropocene in which this is placed. It's an understanding of all interconnectivity. But she writes specifically through the perspective of water mammals or sea mammals.
Marine mammals.
Marine mammals.
Yeah.
Thank you. Can you tell a little more about it?
Yeah. So Alexis Pauline Gums is, she calls herself a queer black feminist, love and evangelist, a marine mammal apprentice. And this is also important that she calls herself an apprentice, because she has a study in writing and English literature and is a poet. Yeah, she's mainly doing poetry and writing. And this book, Undrowned, Black Feminist Lessons from Marine Mammals, she calls it more like meditations. So even though they are chapters, they're like, you can read them. You don't need to read them one after the other. You can just flow with it, mm-hmm. how you feel. And so that's why she calls it meditations. And she calls herself a marine mammal apprentice because she has been studying them, but she's not like a marine biologist or something.
Mm-hmm.
So she stays with the writing and being a poet and being a, I think love evangelist is very good.
It's
well chosen.
It's beautiful.
Because when I was reading the book a few years ago, it came out in like 2020. Yeah, the wording is so well chosen and she has so much love for the marine mammals and writes about them in such a delicate and it's not only poetic, but it's like really filled with love. So I had to cry like most of at the end of the chapters when she
mm-hmm.
kind of shares her love for them also and thanks them that she can write about them. But what's interesting about the book is that it talks about indeed these interspecies communication and she makes these chapters where you can really chew on things. And where she goes into listening and breathing and
let's hear.
Yeah.
You and I are going to read each.
Yeah.
From it. We can discuss it further, but maybe it's nice to just hear it. And then see where that brings us.
So I'll do the one that's called. This is the first chapter called One Listen. How can we listen across species, across extinction, across harm? How does echolocation, the practice many marine mammals use to navigate the world through bouncing sounds, change our understanding of vision and visionary action? Is social media already a technology of bounce, of throwing something out there and seeing what comes back? This is where we start our trans-species communion, opening a space to uplift the practice of listening even more than the practice of showing and proving and speaking up. Listening is not only about a normative ability to hear, it is a transformative and revolutionary resource that requires quieting down and tuning in.
I think that's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah. So the second little part that's part of this first part, listening, mm-hmm. is about river dolphins. Because in every chapter she goes through a different marine mammal. Here it comes. They say river dolphins don't leap as much as dolphins in the ocean. Because of turbid flows of rushing water, they do not trust their eyes. Their eyes grow small. Echolocation becomes crucial. Their listening becomes more nuanced. They become experts of shape and shape themselves to become narrow, reaching forward like the river. River dolphins are all over the world, in the Ganges and Amazon rivers, for example, are not close genetic relatives. But they are remarkably physically similar. They have grown common forms due to their common circumstances. Have you grown that way, riverine, in a context that moves so quickly that looking at it tells you almost nothing? Are you evolving a deeper way of listening where you are? Could we become students of shape, precise enough to move with the grace and flexibility our circumstance requires, even though your river is not my river? I am amazed by how much listening can do, how quickly it becomes less important to be seen, to leap, to show. And those who study river dolphins know it too. Don't bother looking for these teachers who will rarely jump or splash. You have to listen to them. Try to hear them breathe. I breathe in shape. I shape my days while land contours me at two sides. I shape my breath to wind through winding paths ahead. I shape my head to fit the purpose of my breath. My breath is prayer, the shape of life, evolving name. All I can see is just a blur that says life moves. I stay in prayer and reach to listen for your breath.
It's very moving writing, and it's a very moving thought to think that what we hear and what we could actually hear and perhaps not are not hearing could shape us.
Yeah.
And does shape us.
Does, yeah.
And what shape that can take.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on what that could be, the shape? It's metaphorically shape speaking, because of the
I think it's definitely the context of where you are definitely shapes you. I think also if you travel a lot like we do, are luckily be able to do.
Through cultural practice.
Through cultural practice. You experience that too.
Yeah.
And I've been very interested for a long time to visit all the countries of the artists that I work with,
mm-hmm.
because I think there's something that I cannot understand until I've been there to see like what the surrounding was, where they come from.
And that is the shape.
And that's maybe what shaped them. And also in language, how language is shaped by the landscape also.
Do you think you could describe the river that you swim in? It's very nice the way that she said, and I'm shaped between these two banks of the river, these two sides. Would you dare to make an attempt to share maybe what river you're swimming in?
No? I'm very bad at this hype, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Also that question, we can edit out.
Yeah. No, you can leave it in. It's fine. I'm just not, no, it's really, I'm very,
If I can philosophize in general
yeah.
about these dolphins, the river dolphins, of course, their eyesight, I imagine, is also a little worse because of the muddied water of a river.
Yeah.
So a river is often where the existence of the human species finds and reaches that of marine mammals the easiest and the quickest.
Yeah.
Because it is where they sort of convolute, they come together. Those rivers are muddy. They're used for transport, for fishing, these kind of things. So that echolocation, that listening, and those banks, which is other species existing on the side, are all these things together that are shaping it. Interestingly enough, that it's happening while this animal is largely blind.
Yeah.
In a traditional sense of vision.
Yeah.
But everything else more acute. That's a beautiful metaphor.
Yeah, I think it's nice to how she talks about the breathing too, but it connects well to the second part here.
This one is my turn?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That's nice. We thought we would share reading
I
out loud.
I think it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the third and final one for this afternoon. Breath is a practice of presence. One of the physical characteristics that unites us with marine mammals is that they process air in a way similar to us. Though they spend most or all of their time in water, they do not have gills. We too, on land, are often navigating contexts that seem impossible for us to breathe in, and yet we must. The adaptations that marine mammals have made in relationship to breathing are some of the most relevant for us to observe, not only in relationship to our survival in an atmosphere we have polluted on a planet where we are causing the ocean to rise, but also in relationship to our intentional living, our mindful relation to each other. With meditations on the different ways that the narwhal, beluga, and bowhead whales breathe in the Arctic, the ways baby seals learn to redefine breath in infancy, the relationship between the endangered North Atlantic right whale and my Shinnecock and enslaved ancestors, and even a surprise visit by a black-tipped reef shark, this section offers us opportunities to look at what blocks our breathing and the stakes of a society that puts profit over breath. May our breathing open up to the possibility of peace.
Very beautiful. I mean, here you hear also already her interest to make the connection to our daily life and her feminist practice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not only about marine mammals. It's really a base to talk about other things, to see these relationships and that we can learn basically from them. She really sees it as learning, so to say.
And perhaps learning to use what I'm reading also heavy in these texts is a form of knowledge again that doesn't propose the anthropocentric position in the middle of things.
Yeah.
To unblock our breathing, to paraphrase her language, then I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's for you and me, maybe, to unblock our breathing. But I think she also goes into other layers where it's more about the position of the black body and how, yeah, and the whole history of capitalism and slavery. And yeah, I think we have a bit of a different position in that.
You and I speak about. Yeah, no, I understand.
And so also in what it means to unlock breathing is also really different.
Mm-hmm.
But I find it still something very interesting for everyone to think about. And also to indeed just zoom out also a little bit and not only see your own position.
Mm-hmm.
But also not to, I don't, what I like about her is that it never becomes very wishy-washy or like zweverig. I don't know the English term.
Wishy-washy is very good.
So it stays in a way. It's very realistic and it's very it's quite practical. So how you can listen to it and then just think like, oh yeah, you have also all these different animals that live like this. Right?
Mm-hmm.
The echolocation also has to do so much about your surroundings and So if you translate the echolocation into how you deal with daily life, or how you, in my case, how I deal with my team, how I deal with the city I'm in, how, for who do I program, you know, I take it for everything.
And just to, as far as I understand what you're saying, it's what you, it's how you transmit and get back in order to understand location and self.
Yeah.
In relation to everything around you.
Yeah.
There is still direction in that echolocation, I imagine, or the opportunity for direction to understand more specifically certain distances, relationships, positions, these kind of things.
Yeah.
But in general, that's perhaps also why it's marine mammals. There's a fluid state surrounding us.
Yeah, and that's what I like about it too.
That fluidity.
Yeah, I mean, I live now in a different city, and I'm not so close to the water, or I'm close to the water, but not close to the sea. And I just really miss this ability to go to the beach every week.
Yeah.
And just be with the waves and have this this direct relationship with the horizon and the waves that are always different.
It's a different movement.
It's a different movement, yeah.
I wasn't sure how we would play, because we do want to share the sound of sperm whales.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's connected to the echolocation.
The echolocation, the language, and also that anthropocentric position. Because having looked at the link that you sent, it is scientists that are telling us what the sperm whales are saying to each other.
Yeah.
Which still somehow...
I mean,
could be understood as subtitles, which are just invented somewhere.
Yeah,
who knows if we're actually doing a good job here?
I mean, I'm very fascinated by this research where they try to find the language of all the different types of whales, and then the sperm whale they have, they think they found that they have a language, but apparently every family has their own language, so they don't even have all the same language. So it's very difficult to find it. But what I like about this clicking sound that they use is that it's not only for communication, but it's also for the echolocation.
Mm-hmm.
So they use both of it to be connected to everything, basically.
Mm. We're going to have a listen. This was a recording made at San Miguel, the Azores. And according to the information offered with the recording, it was a family of sperm whales with a newborn. And the newborn was being introduced to other sperm whales. And the other information that they mentioned with it, which was interesting, is that it would take the newborn 3 years to learn to speak in the language of the sperm whales. So all of these things are fascinating in a sort of a factual kind of sense, in an academic factual sense.
Yeah.
But if you really think about them, also potentially absurd to understand this kind of information being assigned to what we just heard. I don't know, what do you think?
Yeah.
Maybe it's just me.
No, totally. Like, because it's indeed so strange to put like our human time frame on top of their ways of learning things, you know. Or maybe you cannot even call it learning.
Right.
They're just there.
Yeah, it could have been 12 seasons maybe for the child to learn rather than 3 years.
Exactly. Mm. So also, I find it nowadays very difficult to even to pinpoint things or to say anything, because it's so difficult to think about how would we even talk about this language, you know, that we just heard, or what it is, without framing it in a certain way, and then from which point do we frame it, you know, where do I stand, where do you stand? So it's so...
This is where the evangelical of Alexis helps us, no?
Yeah.
If I understand
yeah.
the text and your reason also to present it, but how I definitely heard it.
Yeah.
Is to understand it through such words so that we don't automatically go to that Darwinist, often modernist way of understanding a natural structure.
Also to think that you would understand the world better when you know this, you know, the sperm whales will not, I mean, they're very bothered by our interruptions, by ships, adding ships to the water and windmills and things like this and drilling. And we add a lot of noise to the ocean, but I think they also in a way adapt again. Yeah, they also adapt again. So it's, I find it very silly sometimes, all this research, because of course I love it that it happens, but at the same time it's like, it's so, for who are we doing this? And why do we need this accumulation of stuff?
I had in the episode with Irena Koppelman last year, we spoke about this a little bit, because she's an artist that does field research and works in the field a lot.
Yeah.
And translate that into works that are seen in galleries and institutions.
Yeah.
And she goes with scientific expeditions. She explained it through the two sides of looking at the same sort of subject, the scientists on the one hand, and she is an artist on the other. So you could almost say that in this expedition, there was an Irena Koppelman as an artist who took on the position, and I don't want to compare them completely, but of an Alexis, of looking at things in a very different way, focusing on a very different aspect of it, creating a different energy, which leads to a different hierarchy or balance of things. And the scientists, on the other hand, and the necessary clash that took place, or the conversation, I should say, it doesn't have to be that violent, but the ensuing discussion that came from that is where the value lay.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that the work leads to something else. I mean, you could say it's similar with Alexis, who is also, it's really like a fight for, it's a feminist book, you know?
Yeah.
So it's also a fight for something else, and it's really for black feminism and the position.
Do you want to say something about the commerciality of these? The last thing that you said.
I mean, so this was actually what I was also thinking, like the fact that we want to know everything and we want to reproduce and we want to make it valid and it needs to have a reason, and because then you can sell it. And capitalism always takes, just if you have a good idea, they will just capitalize on it, even though it was we all know this by now, even though it was a great anti-idea or experiment. So I think it's interesting to have these other types of, and that's maybe also where what Irene Koppelman tries, like to have these other type of voices to disrupt it a little bit and to also cut away a bit this idea of always the validation of things.
Yeah.
You know, things can exist without a reason, or that you don't understand it, or with a bit of humor, you know.
It usually opens things up.
And for me it's also very important, like there's a lot of artists that I am fascinated by because I have no idea how to interpret their work mm-hmm. or how to talk about it or really understand it. And I think that's also the power of art. But the sperm, yeah, with this sperm whale research, of course, in the end, the moment that we think we really understand this language, we will use it for something.
Yeah.
You know, and then it turns from something that we're fascinated in into something that can really be harmful for the sperm whale itself or someone else.
Of course. I can tell, if I may, a quick anecdote, and I should give credit to the podcast Radiolab.
Yeah.
But I heard an episode there, one about pistol shrimp, which is a very small, quite aggressive territorial shrimp that lives in the bayou, a place you know well.
Yeah.
And when the recording begins of the podcast with the mic is just above the surface of the water and it sounds like bacon in a frying pan. Because under the surface, there's hundreds and hundreds of pistol shrimp. They have one big claw and one smaller claw. And that claw closes so fast that it creates a little ball of gas, which is almost impossible to make a ball of gas in water, underwater, let alone sound that comes from the snapping of that ball of gas. During the Second World War and the Korean War, submarines would hide in beds of pistol shrimp because other submarines couldn't find them with radar because the snapping of the claws would distort the echolocation.
But it's the crawfish, no?
Yeah, crawfish, pistol shrimp. Yeah. Same thing. Yeah.
Who are now also invading the European waterways.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then at some point in this podcast, a professor of the University of Wageningen explained how they were using the technology of that ball of gas as being, so we kind of come full circle here, as being a possible application for neurosurgery on live patients.
I mean, I could not imagine how they will use it.
I think that's why we're in the cultural sector.
Yeah, I mean, we can imagine it a little bit.
We can imagine because we're nearing the end.
Yeah,
and we thought of something really interesting to send everybody off with. And depending on when you're listening to this, listeners, you can also use it to put you to sleep, or at least that's how it's being proposed. But it's also commerciality. What are we ending with?
Well, in relation indeed with the commercialization of a lot of things in life, I was looking for the whale sounds and the echolocation and to talk about this language, and I found this track where it's an eight hour whale song.
A good night's sleep.
Good night's sleep. You can have it as white noise or something in the background, but I found it interesting that it's again like not used as something that we listen to because we enjoy these mammals in the sea, but we just use their sound for our own benefits, you know.
It's been abstracted.
And it's been abstracted and it sounds pretty, it sounds like a soundtrack. So I thought it was
separation from the actual animal itself, or the will to want to know more or to establish any kind of relationships. It's for you, what's interesting is the commercialism behind the sound itself and only the sound, irrelevant actually from the animal somehow.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it's totally not connected anymore to the animal. But then, of course, it is in the whole idea of spiritualism.
What's being sold.
And being like in your in the right environment to sleep with your right cushion and your bamboo cushion and your cotton because you cannot use down anymore.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like so, everything is totally correct, and you use your battery powered whatever, and then you listen to these sounds.
We listen to the sounds, but also the whales and what we imagine their environments and their existence to be is part of what's being sold.
Exactly. And
but
it's not like that at all, because it also, now that we speak about this, it also reminds me of this film, The Green... Oh my God. It's it's this substance that they also made. It's basically a kind of apocalyptic film, and they can only eat this artificial food, and they and the whole world is gone basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you die, you have this video of like the world, the green world, how it was.
Mm.
I totally forgot the title. So Soylent Green, that's okay. The film. It's a similar feel, you know, like you live in this totally damaged world, and then you have these moments of pleasure that kind of remind you of something that's supposed to be like that. And it's of course never that.
Is that maybe the difference between listening and nostalgia? Listening being actually understanding your surroundings and using that echolocation to put yourself and position yourself in it. Nostalgia is not having a position and just being able to meander to that spot that serves you best.
I mean, I was talking about nostalgia, and it has to do, I think, also with the memory of a time that's not here indeed, but also your memory is never stable. So your memory also changes all the time, and then to see like old, it's the same as like listening to this song at the beginning.
Yeah,
The Doors.
Faster and slower.
It was in my memory. It's faster, and then still I go back to this feeling of that time, and then you have like this kind of retro image in your head, and that's I think the nostalgia, the romanticized. Or kind of the warm nostalgia has always kind of a warmth to it, right? And a kind of a glow. So there's So it's a nice. That's nice. Yeah, between listening and truly listening and nostalgia. That's a good. I mean, that's very friendly to the capitalists.
Well, let's. I propose we end on a friendly note then.
Yes.
Arlanda Mike, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Hab.
And here are 8 hours of whale sounds. We'll play a fragment, but the link will be in the episode. Thanks again. Thank you.
Thank you.